Well, at any rate, generally speaking, when my father was sent back down to South Bend and we moved down there, it was with the idea that he would build up a much larger staff and to more fully take care of all their needs and to develop future models. They thought, Studebakers thought at this time that that would be far more beneficial to them, and they'd get they were kind of complaining about the kind of service that they were getting. It wasn't as thorough from styling engineering relationship that
even
though, needed to be.
Yes, even though Lowy had him on the account full time.
Oh yeah, he had him working on the account full time, but it's just the distance was hurting, and the need for people to work right with engineers and with the drawings and surface development of models and of the model details and everything was a great deal more than could be handled on a long range basis. Even though Lowy Studios in New York had a staff of model builders and had those kind of people available to them right there in New York to do detail work, it was just a lot more to it in creating car lines, of which they were starting to get into with President and Commander and the Champion series of cars. There are three major car lines. And with all of them needing to be redesigned in order to keep up with General Motors and keep up with Detroit at that time. So initially, when he was initially, then of course, when he came back to South Bend, we moved back down there, initially, then he needed to, as well as concentrate on the design of the next models to be done, the past 1940, 41, 42 models, especially beyond 42, especially preparing for 43, 44, 45, even though the war had not started yet, he needed a larger staff to do that. And besides, there were some government contracts that were starting to come along at that time with the recognition that there was probably conflict on the horizon. And of course, Studebaker had a truck building facility, and there needed to be some facelift work at least done with the Studebaker truck line. So he started to hire quite a few people. And among that group of people were Jack Aldrich.
Was he ever known as Jake?
Jake, yes, yeah. Of course. Jake was his nickname, right. And Jack was his real name.
It's Aldrich, isn't it? D-R-I-C.
Aldrich, right. Mm-hmm. And there was Jake Aldrich, and of course there was Bob Bingman, Tom Dingman.
Bing or Bingaman?
Bingman, B-I-N-G-M-A-N,
right.
Bingman. And as well as John Reinhardt, the modeler, Frank Alroth, A-L-R-O-T-H,
mm-hmm.
or Alroth, yeah. Frank Alroth.
Was Bob Burke among
the Bob Burke was hired later, and that was even after Gordon Bury.
Uh-huh.
Later on, Gordon was not hired by my father. He was made sort of an equal manager to my father at one time, and at one time my father worked for him and he worked for my father. They were very close friends, but
right.
At any rate, it was amazing to be able to carry on being good friends throughout all that, but
right.
They did.
Yeah.
And so
respect for each other.
Yeah, right. And besides, they all hung around together.
Yeah.
There's I'm sure a number of people that I'm leaving out there.
Is there a woman involved
at that point? No, not really. There
one
was
a little bit later, I think. Yeah.
One perhaps a little bit later.
Yeah.
Then later on, of course, there was Ed Herman. And
one N or two M's?
M-A-N-N.
Herman.
And there was at that time some engineering people that were assigned at least to my father's activity, just like there are design engineers today that are assigned to with design staff and at Ford Motor Company, for instance. And so one of those individuals was Dale Cosper, who had been a design engineer for Duesenberg.
COSPER.
That was a good friend of Gordon Burig's when Gordon was working with Arbent Gordon Duesenberg at that time. So there were a group of, 10, 11, 12 designers. Bob Kodal was another one.
Mm-hmm. Come on from Briggs.
Yep. And this group of designers was a pretty elite group when
sure
I got
was.
Right down to it.
Later
on, they became very well known in their own rights at going to other places.
All attracted by your father's, let's say, charisma.
Well, he had a great deal of that, and enthusiasm, especially. And he was a regular guy type of a person.
Right.
And they all had a lot of fun. They were known as the Lowy Gang down in South Bend. That's what they were known as throughout the industry at that time. And they did. They were doing some things, especially after they did the post-war Studebaker. That they got quite a bit of recognition and from their counterparts in Detroit.
Forgive me. Although it was a Lowy unit, and mm-hmm. they weren't mm-hmm. necessarily autonomous. They did. Mm-hmm. They were set apart from the rest. Who did Lowy and your father report to within the Studebaker hierarchy?
My father reported primarily to Roy Cole.
Roy Cole,
was the chief engineer, more or less,
right.
during this period of time.
Still fairly traditional.
Paul G. Hoffman, well, yes, it was quite traditional. Paul G. Hoffman, of course, was the president at that time in the early days. I believe that was it Harold Vance was vice president,
right?
At that time, or was that? I think it was Vance that was.
Right,
and
right.
then under him was Roy Cole,
who was a rather dynamic fellow.
Quite, yes, uh-huh, yeah. At any rate, the gang got going there, and they were turning out models. And then of course the big deal was that the war came along, and. Things were not exactly postponed, but they were. But there was other types of work to be done, and they did a great deal of work between 1940 and 43-44 on military projects. Among them was the Studebaker Weasel, which my father helped to develop along with his group of people, and the duck project.
Amphibian?
Yeah, the Weasel was an amphibian.
Oh, okay.
And it always left him with a little bit of, after that time, a little bit of a kind of a kind feeling for an amphibian, because it keeps popping up once in a while in some of the work that he did later on when we were in business ourselves, and later on after that. This idea of a car running on water, sort of.
Uh-huh,
only
right.
if he could make it good looking and racy and sporty, that would be great, you know.
Yeah.
Which I've run across and things like that. But at any rate,
did Lowy stay on with the wartime unit? Was he involved with the wartime?
Lowy was strictly in New York, and was strictly, my father was put in place in South Bend.
Yeah.
Lowy would come down very rarely and visit the group,
But did he maintain his contract with Studebaker so he was involved with, say, the design of the Weasel, or
it's whatever that his contract was. He got paid for whatever his group did, in effect.
Yeah.
His contract was broad,
right.
I'm sure, and he was in effect given the responsibility and contracted for all things to do with design.
This is a remarkable.
He had
pioneering contract for that.
Well, he had his Wall Street friends that were involved with according to my father.
Sure. Yeah.
And according to Studebaker management themselves, especially
yeah.
Roy Cole, that he had quite a hold over them from that standpoint.
That's interesting.
By the early 40s or mid 40s at least, they really would like to have not had his hold over them, and would not like to have have dealt with him, according to Roy Cole. They wanted to get him out of there.
He was tenacious.
He was tenacious. Other people did manage that, and other people, it became a very good relationship to have Raymond Loewy working for their companies, but he didn't mix from an automotive standpoint. So, at any rate, during that period of time was the war, and they were committed to doing even a little bit of army truck work and things in the nature of camouflage schemes and blackout type devices for headlights and as well as the actual some of the shapes of stampings, hood stampings and whatnot for trucks and detail for new truck designs. They were asked to contribute to that type of effort. And then along the lines of shaping things, modeling things, and suggesting creative design work for like the weasel and the duck and the types of whatever projects they had to work on.
Do you recall that he ever said that he regarded that as something of an interesting period?
Oh, it was very interesting. He thought it was really he was patriotic anyway.
Sure.
Almost, he was offered a commission in the Navy at that time and almost went into the service. A good friend of his did and became a tin can commander. And,
which is very exciting.
Well, yeah, exciting, but
we all
know later.
But I mean, exciting from this standpoint.
Yeah, right.
Dangerous when
you get out. It was that was something else. But he was, because he was called chief design engineer for Studebaker, he was able to get a deferment from going into the service himself. And so he was put on whatever classification it was at that time and was deferred. Several of the people that he had hired and worked under him, they went off to war and came back in several cases. And some of the modelers like Vic Clark, Fred Hornung, and Frank Elroth himself, and some of the designers, I believe that Bob Burt for one came out of the service, then later on, Bud Kaufman, my father hired after he separated from Loewy, actually. So this group of people were still designing cars on the side to their predominantly army work during the war, but they were preparing car designs for the whatever the pre-war or a post-war period would bring.
And now, was there a bit of secrecy involved?
A bit,
yes. It was generally prohibited by the.
Yes, it was generally prohibited, and so it was a part. It was a great deal of it was sort of done as overtime work. Okay. You might say overtime work. Okay.
Really, the beginning of Moonlight.
Oh yes, on a big. Open scale, this was encouraged by Studebaker, and especially like on Saturdays and things like that, they would all be down there in the studio working like crazy on Saturdays for car designs.
Sure, right, yeah.
And then it was in the evenings also, and then the formula was more or less established by Roy Cole for the post-war designs. Incidentally, before they really launched in what they became to be called the post-war designs or designs for the post-war. Of course, the war had started, but. My father's most favorite designs that he was responsible for was, and that was before he really set up this in-house project down there, was the 1941 Studebaker President.
Well, I'd like to hear about that.
And he always felt that was one of his cleanest, nicest, proportioned, and nicest looking cars. Mm-hmm. And we had one, our owned one ourselves, which was a nice looking car, and that he even did a special color scheme for Loewy's own personal version of it, mm-hmm. as well as our own, which was a which became a production color of the tulip cream body with a dark, very ultra dark green top and green stripe running along the side. And of course, a good many of the 1940 and 41 cars were very clean, very good looking overall, uncluttered, honest, purposeful designs. The 41, I would say, and my father always said, of all Detroit cars, they mastered the interim automobile by that time, with the fenders, still separate fenders, but nevertheless blending into the body, generous filleting areas. They were able to handle surfaces by that time and masses by that time in a unheavy looking way, quite a light look, as ponderous as they really were. Good, or some of the most excellent examples I know in his mind, and in my own too for that matter, at that time was the Lincoln Continental was an example of a very, very well designed balanced car at that time. Some of the General Motors products were very nice. The Oldsmobile, Buick, while they were a bit on the ponderous side, they were still beautifully integrated, beautifully detailed, and he always thought that the 41 Studebaker President was among that group of cars, especially with its front end design that was real clean and with the twin grills and very finely detailed. And Ford cars at that time were also quite nice. All 41s, 40s and 41s were while there were some similarities, they were all characterized by this very fine grill work, usually outlined as opposed to the previous year that was unoutlined by a fine frame running around various grill work. And one can, it's amazing how well similar thinking there was throughout the industry, but one can immediately distinguish between 40 and 41 products, while most of the bodies were the same body,
right,
from those 2 years, with the particular detailing that they have from that standpoint, mm-hmm. whether it's a Lincoln Continental or whether it's a President Studebaker.
Right,
it's very, very different and similar, mm-hmm. in the concept for the year. But at any rate, he always liked that particular car. The Commanders were a bit dumpier and whatnot because they're a little bit shorter wheelbase and not quite as much to work with. But he did like the cars. He liked the products that he represented. Mm-hmm. He liked Studebaker products. Had always believed in them because he'd heard about that probably from the time he was a little kid, and was influenced by that more than any other car. But he really did think, in a lot of respects, that Studebakers were a superior car to some of the Detroit offerings at that time, and he believed in that. And maybe not, I don't know. But he used it. He would bring home the competitive cars, even in 1940-41. There would be a different car sitting in the driveway once in a while because Studebaker would purchase their cars, of course, and he brought home Chrysler products, and they had a very distinctive smell to me as a kid compared to Studebakers, yeah. And as opposed to Ford products, and because of the fabrics, materials, and whatnot that they used, and the dum-dum or the smell of the factory that they came out of, and Chryslers in particular were, to me at that time, when he would bring home a Chrysler product, was just the most vile things that ever existed from an odor standpoint.
Really?
And then their plastics, it was the odor of their plastics too, to a great extent.
Yeah.
They were getting in quite heavily to plastics in the early 40s, and they were kind of Baroque in a way, but they were designed awfully heavy, and And my father said, well, there's some really good things going on here. There's nicely the way they can do this, they can do that, and there's some good things there. But yes, I agree, Virgil, the car's awfully clunky and heavy looking compared, and Chryslers were at that time compared to a lot of other Detroit products, at least. But
they had no styling sense.
No, they really didn't, and they were run by the engineering community, of course, at that time, and they had, unfortunately, Zeters, Gelton, and Breer. They had unfortunately gone through the failure of the airflow that further
drove them into conservatism.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And my father, when he started with Chrysler, had to go through that that whole situation.
K.T. Keller syndrome.
Well, K.T. Keller was a super guy.
A nice guy, but he
wound up giving my father really truly backing him up and giving him the green light over the Zeters and people like that too.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Yeah. Because he doesn't have that reputation.
He doesn't, but and they got along very, very well.
Good.
Well, meanwhile, the Lowy gang proceeded to launch into the post-war car designs
that workshop, that woodshedding they'd done on the slide, so obviously gave them a real jump.
Well, it did, but it was handled. Yeah, okay. They
not that it wasn't.
It was done here in Detroit too. I'm sure. You know, yeah. It wasn't. It was that they were in a position to perhaps be able to move faster than Detroit was right after the war too.
Yeah.
I think that they're being a smaller company, that the war effort grew up there greatly. They weren't quite as affected with the unions as Detroit was, the South Bend grew up greatly. They got the labor there and everything, and during the war with Bendix and Olivers and Singer and the industry that was in and Studebaker. The industry that was there collected, and the war effort built up the availability of factory workers.
Right.
Some skilled people too, and they were able to put out the product more rapidly than Detroit anyway, from that standpoint. So
a wonderful flexibility.
Yeah, it was they had good tremendous talent around South Bend.
Right.
They had a lot of old Belgian type wood carving model maker type people that worked they were known for in South Bend even before the war they were able to dye shops and model shops and everything were great. Although the Bud Company in Philadelphia did a great deal of their tooling work and tooling development, and of course
had that been traditional
had been traditional. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nevertheless. The green light was given to the Lowy group to go ahead and develop the post-war car, and especially by 1942-43, and there were a lot of proposals made, and my father was encouraged by Roy Cole to take a team of a couple of modelers and work on it at home in our basement, and to develop a car, and meanwhile the other guys were developing the car up right in the studios.
Now, was
their
this
own
a,
designs.
Now this was as later been written as a one of Cole and Vance's ploys to somehow drive a wedge between your father and
well, I wouldn't say that. I say that there was a wedge developing there anyway. And it was. However, it was promoted by Roy Cole because even my father had trouble getting Lowy out to take a look at making any kind of commitment to the post-war car development.
Okay.
He would show up and make rambling non-decision decisions and take back off and soak Studebaker with an expense account. Literally, he just was going to milk him for everything he could milk him for years. That's what it amounted to as far as contracts are concerned. So he didn't care how fast or how slow things developed. And he kind of put my father in a position of being in the middle between a faction of just letting things go as long as possible before we do anything, and Studebaker management wanting to, hey, let's get going so that we are able to get a car out here just as fast as we can for right after the war. And so they commissioned him, in effect. Roy Cole said, well, look, let's not put up with going through your doing this through your styling section. You go ahead and start to work on this.
Well, from that standpoint, it's a natural development.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were right. Hobbled and trapped by the Lowy commitment, and
exactly.
They were trying it out a bit. Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I interrupt this. This episode that you've begun to describe has been variously characterized as a split, a subterfuge, an attempt to undermine the Lowy influence in South Bend, but the way you've described it is that it really was an attempt to get back to work on the car that
Lowy right.
was dragging his feet, was inattentive, was involved with other projects, and if it wasn't for Roy Cole and your father, God knows what would have happened to the post-war Studebaker.
Well, I can remember my father again telling me about one particular episode where he had models going in the studio,
mm-hmm.
And this was, I believe, in 1943 sometime.
Yeah.
They were always developed models with quarter scale clay models,
mm-hmm.
And
that was
the main method of design, of
yeah.
course,
mm-hmm.
sketches, and then get right into quarter scale clay, and
right.
and
mm-hmm.
There were several models going on during that period of time, and it had been developed for a few months that they were working on, again, a great deal on a spare time basis because their war effort was the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they implored Lowy to come to the South Bend and get him down there to make some decisions about which way to go as
right.
far as the style is concerned. And so a day came when, he was going to come down there from New York. He brought his chief main man with him, who was Breen or Barnhart? Barnhart, I think, was the,
mm-hmm.
They were both Breen and Barnhart worked for Raymond Lowy,
right.
but it was Barnhart, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
in
H-A-R-T, yeah.
D-T,
you're right. And so they showed up and came in to make their assessment on the models, and I believe that Cole was involved in the meeting as well as other engineers and whatnot, and got down to finally going through the models, and Mr. Lowy was very dissatisfied with everything. Yeah. And he could turn it off and on.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, I've heard it myself. He could turn
you?
His French accent on and off anytime he wanted to. Because I had known him myself
sure,
when I
right.
was a little kid.
Sure.
And at any rate, my father said, well, he says, okay, Mr. Lowy, then if you you object to this, he says, I will have a modeler personally assigned to you for this afternoon, and you can work out some of the things with the modeler that you want to change and work into the design.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at noontime, he got a very convenient telephone call from New York, recalling him immediately to New York,
right.
and his henchman Barney had called up New York and told him to call us,
mm-hmm. right.
And that's the way he operated. To hear my father tell it.
So that was quite a dilemma. What was your father's solution to that particular dilemma?
Well, I guess he was able to tell Studebaker, you see what I'm up against.
Okay.
And so then I think is when he was able to convince them. Now, the other people knew this at the same time that were working with my father, and they lamented the situation. The guys hung together. They were more helpless than my father, at least. And of course, my father had to do something about it. And so, or at least he felt that he did, because he really felt committed to Studebaker. And this wasn't doing anything behind Bowie's back. This was simply doing, honoring the commitment that he always felt that a designer should honor to the client, to the employer. And so, yes, he did work for Lowy first, but on the other hand, he couldn't, you know, Lowy never told him he was doing anything wrong at all. It was just that we're just going to put this business off. And, and so then Cole got rather anxious about the whole thing, and that's when he said, okay, you better start working out of your house. My father suggested that, hey, you know, I always got things going on at home anyway, which my father did. He liked to work at home in his own studio and stuff like that, and he was, if he wasn't drawing race cars or dreaming up projects like that, then he was working on fine artwork of some sort or doing things like that at home anyway. And he literally, along with Gordon Burig then by this time, along with Gordon Burig and Bob Burke and Dale Cosper, the four of them went in together. Oh, this was a little bit later on. This was actually a little later on that they did this, but they were always good friends. And this was later on, after the big rift between my father and Lowy.
Yeah.
And this was even after that that the four of them went together and bought a 48 Mercury chassis and started to build a sports car that became the Tasco that Gordon Burig did later on. And so and that was done in our garage at home. But during this period of time, 1943, there was quite a large family trauma that went on, because my brother died as a 2 years old in 1942 as a result of a home accident. And so that was quite traumatic. And then my sister was born in 1943, my oldest sister. And this was all during the period that we lived in South Bend, and my father was worked at Studebaker, of course. And the family carried on normally, with relatives relatively close by, of course, having been from around that area to begin with. During the war, there wasn't hardly any racing, but nevertheless, in 43-44, there started to be just a tiny bit of it. And during this period of time, my father discovered up in the they worked in the about the third floor of the engineering building, was like my father's styling section. Thank you. And during that period of time, he discovered an Indianapolis racing car that was in the up on the fourth floor of the engineering building, it was being stored there. And Studebaker had built a team of five cars for 1932 Indianapolis race that was based on a semi-stock racing formula for that period of time. They had built a team and were very successful, and they didn't win the race, but they placed as high as third and in 1932, and they placed as high as fifth, I believe, in 1933, and they placed all five cars in the first 12 in 1933. And this particular car was one of those team cars that had been built and sponsored by Studebaker, and had been built by the chassis and body had been built by Herman Ringling, who was an Indianapolis race car builder in Indianapolis. And Studebaker lent their time and effort and their machinery and the engine and chassis components and everything to the team being built up, used it for tremendous publicity. And as a matter of fact, ironically, my father had illustrated some of these efforts when he had worked for advertising artists when he was very young, had actually illustrated this particular race car racing at Indianapolis. Well, he wound up buying it from the owner the cars had been, after their racing career, had been sold out to private individuals after 1933, and this particular car wound up in the hands of a person right there in South Bend who managed to acquire it and and all of the parts from the whole team of the five cars, all of the spare parts. And so my father inquired, this was during 1943, he inquired as to who owned it. He was told who, and they were, Studebaker was, he was a plastic supplier to Studebaker in South Bend, and owned Sobenite Plastics. And
what was the company?
Sobenite Plastics, and S-O-B-E-N-I-T-E. And it was raced as the Sobenite Plastic. When he purchased it, it was in 1930, after they sold them in 1933, he last raced it in 1937 at Indianapolis. Louis Tome, the Hollywood stunt driver at that time, who also raced it in Indianapolis, drove it to 10th place in 1937. This particular car had been driven to third place in 1932 by Cliff Bergier. Pardon?
Bergier.
B-E-R-G-E-R.
E-R-E.
In 1933, it was driven to ninth place by Zeke Meyer, in tenth place in ninth.
Is that the famous Meyer? No,
this is Zeke Meyer. No, it's not to Louis Meyer. No, okay. It's Zeke Meyer.
M-E-Y-E-R.
In 1933, and then 37 by Louis Tome. And it was, and then it was stored and forgotten about during the war. Pardon? Yeah, and he came across it about in 1943. And ask about it, and at that time there was it had started to happen before the war, but at that time there was in 1944, there was and with the GIs coming back from Europe and whatnot a little bit, there was getting to be just a tiny bit of what became the sports car movement starting to happen in those days. And and people talked about a sports car as opposed to even a hot rod or a convertible or something like that. They talked about a sports car. And so, at any rate, but my father always loved a race car anyway, so he looked upon this car as something that could be streetable. Mm-hmm. And so he managed to buy the car from a fellow's name was Sanders, Phil Sanders, that owned it and had last raced it at Indianapolis, and bought the car for $500, which was a pretty good amount of money in 1943. But he got all the spare parts with all the whole team with it, and so our garage, and by that time we had rented a farmhouse where this. Again, from the Hoffmans, they owned the house. We had rented a big farmhouse, and unfortunately, that's where the accident to my brother happened. And then my folks finally found a house to buy up on Ekman Street, again, and still the south side of South Bend.
Ekman,
E-C-K-M-A-N. And that's, and we had a nice garage there, and it was just a regular three-bedroom house, a smallish kind of a house, but it was a nice little house, and my folks enjoyed it. But
you remember it?
Active memories are from there, because I was really then by that time from the time we moved up there, 43, I was 10 to, until I actually went to high school, 10 to 15.
The formative year. 14,
yeah. And my most fond memories were that. And, fortunately, my mother went through the trauma with my little brother all right, and my sister was born, and she was happy to have a daughter. But at any rate, the family was always active, and I mean from their great friends, the Schaefers, were there in town. And of course, there was my grandparents nearby, and my other grandmother nearby, and the relatives. Not a huge family, especially not on my father's side, but at least on my mother's side, there was a pretty good-sized family. And on my father's side, they weren't directly his own relations, of course, but there were his cousins in name, and they were fine
foster,
people.
Foster
they
cousins.
Were, foster cousins from up around the Belding, Michigan area, mm-hmm. and that side of the state. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, at any rate, so he was given the go-ahead by Cole to go ahead and develop a car that started out in the basement. And I remember it being pretty well finished up when I was when we first moved there.
When you say finished up, you mean a model?
The quarter-scale model. Okay. Was laid out. He was assigned a draftsman to help work on it, as well as a couple of clay modelers that would come in during the afternoon and evening. Then my father would work in the evening on the model himself, and I even helped put clay on it once in a while and stuff
exciting.
Like that. It didn't go on for very long. It doesn't take very long to do a clay model, a quarter scale model, although it took longer in those days than it did than it does now by a long shot. But to work out different developments on it and themes until you get it just right.
In terms of design, was your father did Roy Cole give your father, in a sense, carte blanche to deviate from the Lowy, the one he had done for Lowy, or?
Well, there wasn't any particular one that he had done from Lowy. It was still the same basic formula. Of the full fendered type, more or less full fendered type of formula, and he had, again, he had his philosophy about what a car ought to be, and he believed that rather than going to a, for instance, other current philosophies that were happening at that time, was, of course, you might say, the full-formed, full-fendered, totally envelope body that you might say would be more or less like the Hudson, 48 Hudson, something like that, as opposed to what became the post-war Studebaker, where unfortunately Studebaker had manufacturing problems to work with. Therefore, the rear fender still had to be an attached rear fender on the post-war Studebaker, but my father would love to have blended that in, but he still wanted a semblance of an automotive form as opposed to what he believed were kind of characterless cars at that time that were upside-down bathtubs, like he characterized the 48 Hudson as being, accused right. of being, at least. He still wanted to have cars have a little bit of lightness to them and in their looks, and to have what he always thought was automotive character.
Right.
So he had carte blanche as long as he didn't deviate from an economical standpoint, from a money cost standpoint, which was always, he learned quickly on to be able to handle quite well.
And right, Cole was a good.
And Cole was a very understanding engineer, good production engineer. They got along very, very well. And,
great team.
Well, and Cosper was a super guy as far as working out anything is concerned.
Uh-huh. Wonderful. Yeah.
Very creative.
But the shadow of Raymond Lowy's contract was constantly looming.
Constantly, and then. And then, so my father left Burke, and then Lowy brought in Gordon Bierig about that time.
Mm-hmm. Deliberately to.
Think Gordon went to Lowy and asked him for a job. I think more than anything else.
He knew what
then,
was going on. Yeah.
He didn't exactly know what was going on, but he soon found out and decided maybe he could do something about it. So then he buttered up Lowy, and then mm-hmm. there was all kinds of subterfuge, you might say. But they were all just great friends.
They were all friendly.
Yeah, I know it. And that was what was funny, because I literally Gordon's wife and my mother were very best friends in South Bend, Betty Buring and that's Gordon's first wife, and my mother were best friends, and it was a strange situation, but at one time my father didn't know if he was running the styling section or if Gordon was. Gordon didn't know it either.
Yeah.
And it was because of this Lowy keeping things up in the air more than any of them.
But this unbreakable contract,
there was nothing they could do about
it. Why was that so for so many years?
Because of the finances. Because of
these connections with the
Lowy's connections with
Studebaker
financiers. Studebaker, yeah, right.
And you con them into thinking that he was the savior of the Studebaker.
Oh, exactly. That's the whole idea. Simply resolved. Meanwhile, the styling section, other designers working with modelers and building up a bank of models and going ahead and starting to get down to a selection day, a real genuine one that Studebaker. So they were going to have this set by a design set by Mr. Lowy. You're going to have to be here. We're going to select a model, meanwhile, my father's working on this model at home, not two different dimensions as has been in any way reported. They were all working under the same dimensions to begin with. I don't know where the different dimensions of business set in, because I have a letter that from my father to whoever wrote about that absolutely was not true. There was never a different set of dimensions. The group and my father never gave a different set of dimensions to the people to his own people that were working on these other models. That how it came about that one or two of the other models were wider than they should have been was strictly their own doings. If that's the case, that my father's own model, which was done in the basement and whatnot, was the same dimension as many as the other models, but I don't know who claimed that there was a difference in dimensions.
The unknown factor here, at least in my comprehension, is how did Lowy take this?
Terribly.
I can imagine.
He fired my father the next day after the models were shown, and they were shown to Studebaker and Studebaker selected my father's design.
It was a competition.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He was so furious.
Indignant.
Said, "Well, I tried to tell you, you know," and so so they kept on with Lowy's, and then is when Bob Burke took over. Lowy's styling section.
Well, Roy Cole must have known that there would be a collision.
Probably,
and that probably Lowy would. Mm-hmm. So, but Roy couldn't hold on to your father.
Yeah, and he hired my father back the next day.
Oh, privately. That's what I want to know. Tell me how that happened.
Well, actually, my father Cole says, "Don't worry about it. You'll be hired back tomorrow under our own styling section."
And that's what happened,
yeah.
And then what happened to the old Lowy cadre of Burke?
Then Burke took that over, because Burke was my father's second man.
Lowy was, in effect, at least at this point, aged out?
No. It was still Raymond Lowy Associates in South Bend with Bob Burke.
As a semi-independent unit, yes.
Just strictly as still honoring the contract and everything.
True.
And
Virgil Exner Senior is now.
He's out.
Is out.
But Studebaker directly hires my father back
as director of styling.
For Studebaker Corporation, right?
Yeah.
Riled. And he says, "Well, you know, you need to hire some people," and so out of that, my father hired Bud Kaufman, and he had Ed Herman work for him interior wise. Oh, Randy Farrow he hired after that.
F A F.
A-R-R-O-U-T.
Okay.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
And then they competed from then on at that time from 1944. This was about, you know, this was in 45 that this happened.
Uh-huh.
And they then continued to compete from then on between the two styling sections. I guess to Baker Thornhill, this is a pretty good deal, really, you know. Yeah, we got some work out of both of you.
That's marvelous.
But,
well, it certainly did shake things up.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the stuff for 1950, like my father really developed these front fenders that shot forward on his models.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Lowy gang picked up that, but then they came out with that 1950 Studebaker with the three-pronged look, and my father just thought that was awful.
Uh-huh.
But at least he had contributed, he wanted to make a horizontal. That was his next phase of design that he was going to get into, and that was greatly influenced by European cars then by that time, to start to get into the low hoods with the fenders protruding and into that was the influence of the Cisitalia to a great extent.
Sure.
Some cars like that, some European
like
stuff. Yeah, but at any rate, that was the kind of designs they were starting to get into. The post-war, his biggest contribution on the actual post-war model that became the picked model, of course, was the initial development of the wraparound backlight. And also even prior to that, even on the 1942 Studebaker, which was the very last car before the war, was a center pillarless windshield. They had an actual curved windshield on the 1942 model, their older body styles.
Right.
They actually had a curved without the center divider bar on the windshield. And of course they carried that out in 1946 on the 46 models. And the idea of the front end was new, and the full bodies and whatnot. They were really the first car that came out after the war, of course, with a modern formula for bodies, even though shortly after that Ford and GM came out with, I suppose, more advanced models of that basic philosophy that was picked up after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Although my father always felt that his cars were lighter looking than they were, and and he always believed in a light looking, agile, fast looking car, and thought that the 46 Ford, while it was nicely done and very honest in design and everything else, it still represented something that was a little bit slavish, a little slab-sided, and a little like that.
Mm-hmm.
And GM was starting to do things that were a little bit heavy-looking in their own way. But at any rate,
did
those
you say
are
the 49 Ford?
Pardon? 49 Ford, yes.
You know the story behind that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
With Bob Cotto and
Bob Burke, yeah.
And Bob Burke.
Well, the breakup is obviously looming ahead here in the late 40s.
Why well, sir, then he just couldn't keep up with Lowy's design section. He was he was given his own studio out at the Studebaker Proving Grounds.
Mm.
Meanwhile, these people all still were good friends with each other, and at that time that they were having a lot of fun with my dad's race car and going to the only sports car club meets that they ever had at that time, and the Sports Car Club of America was beginning to develop on the East Coast. And by 1946, when the war was finally over, and even in 1945, even in 1944, we saved up gasoline rationing coupons, and my dad and I drove east from with the Indianapolis race car, drove all the way out east and came back. And those were some very memorable trips, of course. And he was, even when I was a little kid, I was always interested in, continually, father confided both my mother, of
That's
course,
great.
And myself,
yeah.
With what was going on at all times about this design stuff, and I was even I always had a little clay model going at one time or another, and my father would bring home clay, or sometimes when I'd go up there on Saturdays or whatnot, when he was working up at Studebaker's, then I'd have my own little model car that the modeler's got to give me, loan him tools to work on and stuff like that.
About this time, you're involved in the Fisher Body company. Mm-hmm. How'd that come about?
Well, this was when I was in the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. It was a social studies class that mm-hmm. handed out these usual newspapers on Fridays, I think it was, what was the name of that? Something like Social Studies World or something like that, mm-hmm. little newspaper that all the kids got at that time. And there was an ad in it to design a model car, win a college scholarship. Mm-hmm. I was 12 at the time, and so I brought it home, and I had recognized it because the idea of it was, because my father had always told me that in 1937, when he worked at General Motors, he had been a judge on one of these contests.
Right.
Well, I brought the thing open, and I said, look at this, I'm going to enter this. This is mm-hmm. going to be fun,
yeah.
To design a car. And then it's when they told me about, well, did you know your father judged that contest? And they were surprised that I'd picked up on it. And I said, well, no, I didn't know he judged the contest. Well, he said, well, he did, and he was involved in that. And I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be neat and a lot of fun to do. And so I started to draw cars. This was in the fall of 1945. And I was always doing model airplanes and all that type of thing at that time, and so I got some clay and started to model a quarter scale model, made up a buck, and started to model. It wasn't quarter scale, no, it was 12th scale, mm-hmm. For a tenth for the contest, yeah, and started to work roughing out designs as well as to draw up designs for the contest. Mm-hmm. And then in the early spring of 1946, as it came closer to the deadline and whatnot, then I had to really work on it harder.
Mm-hmm.
So then I turned out a finished clay model and cast it plaster at that time, and made the mold and then cast the car in plaster. It was getting closer to the deadline, and I put it in my mother's oven to dry it out, the plaster.
Really?
And
that's
it
wonderful.
Cracked, and I had to repair it.
Oh, no. Do it all over again.
And, well, not all over, but, I mean, at least I had to patch it up
yeah.
and then sand it, finish it, everything else. My father helped me quite a bit, but mm-hmm. but I had to hew out every last little piece of detail out of aluminum chunks and file them and polish them and everything and assemble it. And as it turned out, I won first place in the junior division in 1946. So it wasn't really what I consider the beginning of my design career, because I kind of consider it having gone through it from the time I was born, being
exactly.
sort of in it.
The
but,
wonderful ambience.
But
it
was always it was a very important thing in my life, naturally.
Yes, sure.
And to get a scholarship, well, that took care of my education to a great extent.
Now, what was that, to GM Institute? Or?
No, it was just a $4,000 university scholarship.
Wonderful.
Could go any place. I mean, it just was the idea they gave you money to,
perfect.
If you got into college, then you could spend it on.
Where
that.
Did you? Where were you? Where did you eventually go?
I went to the University of Notre Dame.
Good.
And
by then,
of course, we were living there. But by then, though, my father went back up to Chrysler.
Yeah.
Yeah, started with Chrysler.
But by then, the Notre Dame had probably had a better industrial design department than they have in Europe.
Well, actually, I started in architecture. And yeah, they didn't have too much of a better art department, really, when it got right down to it.
No.
But yes, considerably more.
Mm-hmm.
But they were quite well known for architecture, and they were doing very well that way. And the thought was that, well, okay, it's best that you get some engineering background as well as art, and that was thought to be the best route to travel. It didn't work out that way, but nevertheless, that was thought to be that. Well, at that time then,
mm-hmm.
we have what I guess is a what we'd call a Mexican standoff here at Studebaker. Your father.
Yeah. In 1945, when yeah. when the big show came up and the big showdown came up, my father's model was already it was selected, and Loewy was really upset, naturally. It was called a stab in the back, but it really wasn't, and it was and Loewy did fire my father. And immediately, the very next day, he was hired back with full approval of Studebaker Corporation, who could still do nothing to oust Loewy that they wanted to.
Yeah.
But he was hired immediately, and then he was put in charge of the complete production development of it.
Yeah.
And he even used some of his people, worked on that, and further detailing and whatnot.
No, that's interesting. He was to do the actual production and development.
Right, the production development.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Which was worked out with. He was given the carte blanche to hire whomever he could hire to begin with, and I can't remember if he hired somebody away from Loewy right then and there. I can't remember how that worked, but of course he had engineers to work with. Dale Cosper was assigned by Studebaker, and he had some other people to actually work with him as far as that's concerned, and he was perfectly capable of handling doing a whole car by himself if necessary anyway. As it turned out, then they went on and got the car in production. And then subsequent years with facelifts, minor, most of them were minor through 1949.
Didn't he get the first post-war car out, pretty much?
Pardon?
Didn't he get the first post-war car in the industry?
Yes,
first?
It was, 1946,
right,
of course.
Yeah.
It came out in late to autumn 46. Mm-hmm. First post-war car.
Didn't know
whether it was coming or going.
That
was the big advertising deal. They got a lot of publicity that way. Who was it that said that? Somebody like couldn't tell whether it was coming or going. It was Bob Hope, or it was
popular radio comedian.
It was a popular radio, Fred Allen, or somebody like that. Made some comments like that, and it got quite a bit of publicity, and was extremely successful. It got them up to as high as, I believe, it was at least fourth place, and they may have touched third place in the whole industry during 1947. Mm-hmm. Of course, they beat the industry to the punch, and the industry didn't have their cars, the new ones, out by that time.
Right.
So they had a bunch of old cars, and the public was waiting to a great extent to buy the their new offerings, which would wait until 48, 49.
Right.
And so it was natural that they were doing as well as they did, as well as they were economical cars, and they were quite good products, and especially the Champion was a great success. And the other factor, of course, was that the public meanwhile needed new cars too. And so because everything was shot during the war, there wasn't any production during that time. But this kind of rapidly got us to 1946, and I've touched upon my own Fischer Body career at that time, and our affinity with the Indianapolis race car, and the beginnings of the Sports Car Club of America, which started out as a group of Eastern car enthusiasts that grew out of the pre-war, just prior to the war, the American Race Drivers Club, ARDC, in the East, of which Bill Mitchell, incidentally, was a big supporter of back in the late 30s, early 40s, and people like and it was also a came out of the Vintage Car Club of America and the Antique Car Club of America, which were largely Eastern oriented, Eastern organizations. But during they would have very large meets for all these cars. Usually these clubs were kind of combined, and out of this grew the Sports Car Club of America, which had such notables as Dave Garraway and Briggs Cunningham, and Peter Helk were members of this organization, which in those days you had to own, in the very earliest days of the Sports Car Club of America, you actually had to own a car, and it had to be passed judgment upon as whether it was a true sports car or not, even, to be allowed to be a member of this very exclusive club. Mm-hmm. They were kind of honored to have my father as the chief designer of Studebaker, especially after he was given credit for having designed the post-war car in 1946-47, and he owned this Indianapolis racing car, which they looked upon, unfortunately, as an Indianapolis racing car and not a sports car. We had just drove 750-800 miles to go to their sports car club meets, and if that didn't meet the criteria of being a true sports car, nothing did, and they more or less accepted that later on, except there were some incidents that proved a bit otherwise. It was funny. Those trips that we made, of which there were about five or six annually, and we'd save, during the war parts, as I said before, we'd save ration coupons up to be able to take the tour across. I was the riding mechanic, of course, a little bit too young to drive, although my father let me drive. My mother actually taught me to drive.
Really?
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. But at any rate, when I was 13, actually I learned on the 41 President Studebaker. That's where I first truly learned to drive. Mm-hmm. And then we had that car until 1946, until we got a post-war car, so mm-hmm. during the war. And so, at any rate, the sports car aspect of this whole thing became important. And even after the Lowy and my father's rift, and Studebaker, and he worked for Studebaker independently, of which he hired people at that time like Bud Kaufman and Randy Farrow and worked at the Studebaker Proving Ground with his own little studio there, and made proposals for the next big major body change, which was recognized to be either 1949 or 1950. And so there were many kind of exciting proposals that I have photographs of, that are mock-ups of the proposals that both he and the Lowy contingent, and by now run by Bob Burke at this time, proposed for production, and a kind of a combination of them came out in 1950. The minor facelifts that were made between the 1946 or 47 post-war Studebaker and 1949, for the period of two and a half years there, were all of my father's little ornamentation differences,
right.
And little and they developed the Land Cruiser at that time, which was the bigger car that replaced more or less the President, and the three basic car lines then became by 1949. They became the Champion, the Commander, and the Land Cruiser, and that was their main car lines, as well as the 1948 Studebaker truck. That was another major breakthrough. My father always felt that was one of his nicest. The front end design for the pickup truck was one of his nicest design contributions.
Was it 4950?
It was the modern again. There when they replaced their it was either 48 or 49.
Mm-hmm.
That was when they facelifted that mm-hmm. that from the pre-war model.
Right.
It was a very nice simple front end with a slot air intake design, separate slots that composed the grill.
Right.
All of the designers during the war naturally were greatly influenced by aircraft design, especially wartime fighter planes and things like that. Hence, that became the reason for the spinners that you saw in the 1949 Ford and all the bomb type bullet type bumper designs and ornamentation, and especially hood ornaments and rocket shapes and machine gun slots and that form of that type of philosophy too.
Yeah.
Now, it will come out later that there's going to be a rift there between a lot of people that really totally went off after that type of a philosophy, and this is wartime, of course, and that never were able to adapt to other than that, as opposed to getting back to the more honest, what is an automobile, where are we really going? And will we, and the philosophical difference between we're a world of cars as opposed to just the United States of cars or Europe as cars, and the appreciation of cars overall versus only American cars are the only cars in the world, and this is all, of course, still without any kind of schooling coming into the whole thing, without
yes.
any kind of you see, architects have accredited schools to go to, engineers accredited schools to go to, doctors, everything, professional people, the automobile design community and styling community, really, or industrial design. There was a bit of that, Pratt Institute. MIT, a tiny bit of that, but there was virtually, by that time even, there was virtually no formal schooling being built up. There was a little tiny bit of an association of industrial designers, but that didn't amount to very much, my father, for instance, even when he was at Studebaker's, was invited to be a chairman of the American Society of Body Engineers, and joined the SAE himself, and became very engineering oriented himself. Gave several speeches on what's the future of cars, and two notable speeches are Dangerous Curves Ahead, which was before one of the SAE conventions in French Lick, Indiana. And was quite accepted by the engineering community, mainly because friends like Roy Cole and Dale Cosper welcomed his integrity as far as being a stylist with real automotive and engineering feeling, and they embraced that very much. Basically what went on, there was the competition, of course, that was taking place from the time of the big rift between my father and Loewy and Studebaker, and then from then on it was a matter of making development for the next big phase, but mostly it was a matter of simply detailing out and making minor facelifts from the 1947 through the 1949 models. And as I said, during this period of time, my father's interests, along with a lot of other people there, especially in 1947, 48, early 49, was carrying along this work. Times were reasonably good there, and getting back, the country getting back together after the war, and racing restarting again, the Sports Car Club of America growing up, and the interest in foreign cars among designers, which will lead to some very important things later on, and a molding of philosophy of car design. There being no schools are available for designers quite yet, but soon America would grow up with the idea of education.
Your father probably had some very strong ideas on this. did he not?
Oh, very much so.
Getting education?
Oh, yes, very much so, because he always talked about, even from the time that he was sent down to Studebaker to hire people, and especially it was difficult to hire people then after that during the war. They mm-hmm. were usually involved in the war, but as soon as they came back, he was able to get them. But we get some very nice people, like Bob Burke was very well-spoken, reasonably well-educated and whatnot, but literally had no kind of design training whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people like that, they were either with the old car companies back in the old days, or they just were young kids coming up. Bud Kaufman was an example of that.
Right.
Yes, they wanted to draw cars, they wanted to design cars, but they just really had no kind of any more training than my own father had
right.
as far as specifically knowing how to go about it. And so for the most part, they were just self-taught artists, hardly most of them, because they had that kind of an interest, a mechanical interest. while most of them did have some pretty decent art, fine art background. They were neither fish nor fowl, and he always lamented the fact that there wasn't some kind of a school type education that would take care of that,
mm-hmm.
That would give these people some basic training and educate them at the same time. He did not favor a trade school type of
thing.
That's good. He favored one of the few people that was Dale Cosper was a graduate engineer, of course, but among designers, Gordon Burig was the only was one of the very few college graduates in any
really?
Way. Yeah, right.
Did he have an engineering degree?
No, I don't believe it was an engineering degree. I think it was a liberal arts degree or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But he was one of the very few that was
mm-hmm.
what the community thought was educated, you know.
Right, yeah.
And father hadn't graduated. He'd gone to college, but he hadn't graduated. And my mother always got a kick out of holding her. She held a business degree, only 2-year business
yeah.
college degree.
Yeah.
I graduated from college, but they were conscious of that, and they knew the importance of that. And then when during that period of time, when I won my scholarship, then they put that used that. They didn't use that money, but being that my education was partially assured, at least
mm-hmm.
monetarily, when we moved up to Detroit, when my father was hired by Chrysler, I went to Cranbrook school,
wonderful.
Private school, and so they used that as a, because our next door neighbors, one of my best friends, were Easterners, pretty well brought up as Easterners, and believed in the private education,
mm-hmm.
and they told my folks, you know, Virgil isn't getting too much out of public high school even then,
yeah.
Let alone now.
Right.
That's how that came about. But
to sum up the
Lowy situation.
Wait,
overall.
Let's hold it for a second.
Oh, okay.
That's too important to. You were saying before we took
mm-hmm.
a short break about the relative dearth of industrial design
schools in any way. Right.
Pratt
was
tentatively reaching out about this.
They were, yes, I think so.
Under the Costellos?
I believe so.
Yeah, yeah.
That was about the only place mentioned. Yeah. Art Center hadn't really even hardly begun until about 1950, something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah.
And there were...
There was the Cleveland School.
There was a Cleveland School, but it was very infinitesimal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. University of Michigan, they had an industrial design, a bit of one at that time, I think. Architecture schools were not supplying anything because they were very specialized, as we
right.
came to find out.
Right.
There was another school. I mentioned MIT. Did they have something going at that time? They may have had something going.
Industrial design.
I don't know, but only industrial design. Of course, we called ourselves industrial designers.
Sure.
You know, really,
that
was the basis of everything, however, even at that time, there was a bit of the rift going on between people calling themselves industrial designers and car designers.
Right, yeah.
And that was even going on then. It was felt that, if you were a car designer, you weren't an industrial designer.
You were a stylist.
Stylist. And the car designers felt that, hey, man, unless you can design a car, forget it. Anybody can design a toaster, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the feeling. That was the feeling at that time.
Yeah.
Now, there were, Brooke Stevens was an important person during that period of time.
And, of course, he and... Mm-hmm. And Teague and Belgiades and others had formed the industrial.
That's right. They had. Now, as it turned out, Brooke Stevens and my father became very, very good friends with this, because he was a big member of the Sports Car Club of America too, that went on during this time, and Brooke Stevens was truly crazy about cars and was a good car designer.
Mm-hmm.
But his main business was pots and pans, and
that's
he made
right.
good money at it.
Yeah.
And in fact, he almost hired me at one time. But I almost went with. That was after that was before I went to Ford. But yes, there was at that time. It was very difficult to. No one was trained, and so my father always said, you know, it's like getting people off the street practically, you know, and you got to train them, if they have a little bit of talent, my God, get them.
Sure.
You couldn't tell. There was no philosophy then. That's what he was complaining about more than anything.
Right.
That there was no conviction.
Uh-huh.
I want to be a car designer, but I don't know how cars should look.
Mm-hmm.
Even he had an idea when he was a kid about how he thought cars really should look. It wasn't just an idea of making a pretty picture of a car and without having a conviction about what a car ought to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, at any time in its history, it ought to look like this. It ought to be this. It's near as far as we can go with our thinking of what we ought to be able to do, and its role in life, as far as primarily providing transportation, of course.
Right.
But at any rate, that pretty much, I think, sums up the South Bend, the Studebaker connection.
Well, one more question.
Mm-hmm.
You had begun to talk about your father's feeling for the need for industrial designers and car designers and car engineers to have a
work together.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
And with his famous SAE speeches that you mentioned.
Yes, and where is the future of car design
exactly.
going? To honesty, integrity. He presented what the in those papers one in particular what the. What his impression of what the French school of thought was going and
that?
The our danger. Well, one of them was our dangerous curves ahead, and the other one is what is the car of the future, or something like that. They're both SAE papers.
Can you get us copies of them?
I have them in that all of that.
Perfect. Okay.
Stuff.
Good.
That's
okay.
There are several copies.
Wonderful.
So
he was attempting to publicized in the best possible forum, the SAE, the need for a rapprochement between those two disciplines.
Yes, very much so, and the need for engineers and whom he felt were getting a bit cast ironish, and he already had his best friend was Dale Cosberg,
right.
who was a tremendously creative engineer. So
right.
he knew how good an engineer
how
could be.
How good it could be. How creative it could
That's
be.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he was very much preaching the idea of you know that the car designer, that the stylist needs to be honest,
right.
and it can't go too Frenchy.
Right.
French school of thought,
exactly.
or too flamboyant, and by the same token, there's room for improvement in the basic overall car. It should be lower. It should be more stable. It should be perhaps aerodynamic. Should get into it a bit. Things
mm-hmm.
like that. He'd already had some experience working with that type of thing with.
Right.
In the University of Michigan wind tunnel with the 47 development of the 47 Studebaker.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's where he
mm-hmm.
used it. That's good.
And so it was And what is the role of the foreign car, and what is the role of the public? Where do they stand? What should they get, out of this, a fair shake in both ways? If they're excited about materials and fabrics and things like that. Well, these are early pushings of philosophy that he was really doing. And it was nice that he was accepted from that standpoint by the engineering community to do this. And he continued to do that while he was at Chrysler also. He continued to...
Well, the big breakup is imminent. How did it actually occur?
Well, the big breakup was simply that obviously there wasn't too much of a future left in South Bend, and Roy Cole was actually getting ready pretty much, I think, at that time for retirement, I believe, and Roy was making my father's availability known around Detroit, and said, I'll see what I can do, and as a matter of fact, the first thing that he did was come to Ford and talk to John Oswald.
John Oswald, really?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure I knew this.
Oh, well, this, I have a letter to this exact effect. Well, it was just a contact that he made that Virgil Exner may be available from Studebaker, and would you be interested? And
reasonably forward-looking.
And he said, well, I guess I'd be very interested. It was during the summer of 1949, or it was early in 1949. I'd already had to be tutored to get into Cranbrook because my mathematics was not very good. And my folks were looking forward to sending me to Cranbrook in the fall. By early 1949, my father knew that he was going to come to Detroit one way or another, and thought very much that he would be coming to Ford.
Oh, really?
And
Oswald had been receptive to his...
Not only receptive, but virtually said, go come up and look for a house, and you will become the chief designer of Ford. You will become what George Walker became. They made a verbal agreement to that effect. My folks came up several times. They committed for a house. Mm-hmm. It was a very large salary and everything. I mean, it was just fantastic, you know. And so, and there were people up here that my dad already knew that were working for Ford, like that had worked for him at Studebaker. There was Cotto and Aldrich and Reinhardt he wasn't here by that time. No, I worked for Bud when I virtually first came to. But there was a bunch of people like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they started to build up a group of people. Apparently it was under Ernie Gregory at that time, it was George Walker's consultancy. Okay, yeah. So, but at any rate, Oswald told my father that you come up look for a house. Yes, we're very interested in that. And then about midsummer, I have the letter. Oswald wrote to my father and said, I'm sorry, we have decided to that we cannot proceed with our agreement at this time, that the company wants to hire for Walker and to bring in his associates and become the in-house design at that time, and that's been decided.
Oh, what a terrible mistake that was!
Well, you never can tell whether it was or not. You know,
wonderful conflict. What might have happened?
Well, as it turned out, it was awfully good the other way. Yeah, I mean, true. You know. So what can you say? Yeah. Who knows? Mm. You never can tell. My father wasn't the greatest, most stable person in the world. It may have gone to his head even more than that did, but because my father was an egotist too, to a certain extent.
But he was on firmer ground than, say, George Walker was.
Well, that depends on how he would have been treated by the Fords. Now, as it turned out at Chrysler, he was treated by the hierarchy very, very well, and he always managed to get along with people from that standpoint, and I think that he would have gained the confidence of the Fords, and I think they'd have been better off.
So.
But you just you never can tell, you know.
Isn't that fascinating? Mm-hmm. What a difference that may have made, because the Walker influence was so devastating.
Well,
in some ways.
In some ways, it was. I mean, you know what? I think, in looking at it, I'll have to tell my own story as far as my own first impressions of coming to Ford and working for Ford. And believe me, for 21 years, I enjoyed working for Ford tremendously,
sure. Yeah.
Of course. But at any rate, it's it.
Well, the specter of what might have been is
George Walker. You know. Maybe his hands were tied to, but he lacked a bit of conviction as far as what cars.
He wasn't a designer.
Well, a bit more of a designer than Ray Malloy, but
well, yeah,
you know, but had.
But I mean, he wasn't a true designer.
He
was another manager, another packager.
Very much so. Unfortunately, we Exners probably lack a bit of managerial ability. I do certainly, but my father had more than I had.
Yeah.
Probably more. Political respect, maybe.
Uh-huh.
At any rate, it's was the beginning then of the transition, and then of course with the Ford deal falling through, then quickly, luckily, Cole said, well, you know, we'll try Chrysler, and as it turned out, then really it was half the amount of money. They had to scramble around, give up their big dream house that they were going to. They always looked forward to building, designing houses. I mean, to have doing that sort of thing together, and then we were suddenly looking for a house in Birmingham, which turned out to be great. And then of course he did start with Chrysler with a very solemn, good promise.